Welcome to Connectify Conversations. My name is Sean Topshi, and I'm the Director of Business Development at Connectify. Our mission is to share the experience, expertise, and insights from gaming industry leaders that comes from years of navigating the complexities and impact of compliance. On this episode, I am joined by special guest.
My name is Derek Ram. I'm the Global Head of Advisory Services at Connectify Advisors.
Thanks for joining us today, and remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can also learn more anytime at Connectify.com. That's KINECTIFY.com. All right. It is my pleasure to introduce new coworker and friend, AML expert, chieftain of CFT, crusader of compliance, house of the graying beard at this point, and global head of advisory services at Connectify, Derek Ram. It's great to have you on the team, and I'm really excited about having you on the podcast today.
Thanks, Sean. I'm not sure what to do about that introduction, but appreciate it.
Derek, for those people that don't know you quite yet, I would love if you gave us a background on yourself as the many titles I just jokingly went through. And for you've done a lot in gaming and anti-money laundering internationally at the public level, at the private level. So would really love for you to dive into your background for us.
Sure. Hopefully I don't bore folks too much. I'll try and keep it interesting. I've had a very fortunate career. I've been very lucky in many of the roles that I've had over the last 30 years. I started my career in the private sector, working for what at the time was one of Canada's largest independent investment management firms. I was there when the horrific events of 9/11 happened, and my role, I was in compliance at the time, primarily focusing on trade compliance and what you'd consider SEC compliance and things like that. But after 9/11, my role changed considerably. Governments around the world passed all kinds of anti-terrorism legislation. Canada, coincidentally, right around the same time, passed anti-money laundering legislation, actually about a year before 9/11. And so my role at the investment firm shifted very quickly to anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing, which I found was fascinating work. And after a few years after that, INTRAC, which is the Canadian Financial Intelligence Unit, so similar to FinCEN in the United States, approached me looking for some expertise in capital markets. And I thought that would be the coolest thing. So I joined FinTrac, spent the first couple of years there focusing primarily in the securities industry, the capital markets, et cetera. And then my boss at the time, who was a retired police officer, really didn't see much of a difference between the stock market and gambling, called me into his office one day, true story, called me into his office one day and basically said, there's not really much difference in the stock market and gambling, so I'm going to also put you in charge of the casino desk. So that's literally how I fell into the world of gaming, because I had a boss who didn't think there was any difference between the stock market and gaming. And so I've spent probably the last almost 20 years of my career in the gaming industry in various capacities. A lot of it in Canada. When I was with FinTrac, I was privileged to do a lot of my training down at Homeland Security's facility in Georgia. So FinTrac sent me down there. I got my certificate in international banking and money laundering, which is effectively the same course that most U.S. federal law enforcement agents get. So IRS criminal investigations, even the U.S. Postal Service in terms of mail fraud investigations. So I did a lot of my first sort of real schooling in AML, other than in the private sector, was at Homeland Security. And that was a real eye opener. In terms of gaming, I spent probably about 8 years at FinTrac, the latter half of those years really working on the casino file. I moved to Ontario Lottery and Gaming, which was a large government-owned crown agency in Ontario that managed at the time. It was just over 25 casinos, land-based casinos. Online gaming hadn't really hit the market yet. So built the AML compliance program pretty much from the ground up at OLG. And then from there moved into more of a regulatory role, joined the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario. And there I worked actually in our police bureau. The AGCO has 150 police officers assigned to it that do all kinds of enforcement, gaming, cannabis now, horse racing, liquor. So I ran the intelligence branch there for just under 2 years. And then the private sector came calling again. And actually during that time, because I think we may get into this in terms of some lessons learned. While all that was going on, I was approached by the government of Bermuda, and they were setting up a gaming industry on the island there. And I was asked to sit on their commission as a commissioner. So did that for just over 2 years, made a lot of great contacts there. Again, given Bermuda's proximity to the Eastern Seaboard in the US, you know, made tons of contacts in New Jersey, New York, worked with a lot of US gaming folks. It was a great time. Unfortunately, it came crashing down. Maybe we can talk about that a bit later. And yeah, spent some time in the private sector doing advisory services with one of Canada's largest law firms. It's a great experience. And then to round up this long and storied tale, I in 2021, when the government of Ontario launched iGaming, I went back to the Gaming Commission to help set up the regulatory framework for internet gaming in Ontario. And spent the last 3 years there, and until here I am now at Connectify.
But. And I think it's safe to say, and thank you for that background, you've certainly made a difference, especially in the province of Ontario, where you've done so much of your work and spent so much of your professional career. I would love, and we're certainly going to get into lessons learned, but I'd love if you could talk a little bit about why you joined Connectify. I mean, I know you've been in the private sector before, but this is probably a little bit different of a role, a little bit different of a company than you've probably really ever worked with before.
Yeah. Oh, other than the fact that, Sean, I've known you for a few years. I've known Joseph, the founder and CEO, for a few years. I think Connectify, it's just an absolutely fascinating company that can really do something different in the gaming space. When you look at anti-money laundering, so much of the focus, whether it's through regulatory agencies or in the press or even at industry conferences, it's always on banking. And because the bankings are the behemoths of AML, right? Like most of the CTR, SAR, LCTR, STR reporting, like the banks contribute a massive amount of reporting to various financial intelligence units around the world. So a lot of the solutions, whether it's technical or advisory, whatever, typically are geared towards financial institutions like banks and credit unions. And I've seen that throughout my career. Like I said, I've spent 20 years in the gambling industry, and they're really, up until recently, there hasn't been a solution that's actually geared for the gaming industry. And with Connectify, one of the interesting things when I first met you folks right out of the gate was, okay, here's a bunch of people that have actually worked in the gaming industry in various roles, whether it's compliance or actually worked on the floor or whatever. So you've got a bunch of folks who know the gaming industry that know the pain points, particularly when it comes to financial crime compliance, and are working to build a solution that will work for the gaming industry. And frankly, I think that's unique. I have yet to see a company do that. And I think the fact that's what drew me to Connectify, but it's also, I think when you look at the folks who are backing Connectify, there's clearly an interest in the from the industry in coming up with a solution that makes sense for the industry.
Yeah, and to echo that, obviously, we were thrilled to be able to announce recently Aristocrat onboarding as one of the investors, as well as former CEO of Caesars Entertainment, Mark Fisora. But yeah, it doesn't seem like it would be a rocket science approach, but there really hasn't been a group that's decided to attack this from, hey, let's bring on subject matter experts who have worked in the industry, loads of them, and then have them get feedback from all of the people they've met throughout their career. And then bring on modern technologists and use that to build out a product that works specifically for the industry. I joined for very similar reasons that you did. I obviously believe in Joseph's vision, but thank you for that background. I'm obviously super excited to have you on the team, I think is the best way to put it. But let's jump into Ontario. Let's jump into more of the AML, the real content we want to cover today, and then we can get into some of the more national and international conversations that I really want to pick your brain on. But we'll start with Ontario. And you were brought back on, at the AGCO to help launch the iGaming market in Ontario. 2 years in, Ontario has seen a lot of success in rolling out iGaming, but there's certainly pain points. So I'd love for you to talk about some of those and maybe how you think they can be improved.
Sure. Yeah, I do think overall, we need to keep it in perspective that, especially for Canada, given the complicated legal framework for gambling, that we need to keep it in perspective that Ontario is very much a success story. The fact that a jurisdiction in Canada was able to do this and do it in such a way, relatively low, I guess you can call it tax rate, a revenue sharing arrangement, open market. There's no limits on the number of businesses that can apply for registration. The cost of entry is relatively low compared to other jurisdictions. By and large, it's been great. It's certainly been the last 2 years, most of the international events I've been able to attend, it's definitely been a lot of buzz. We're not quite 2 years into this yet now, and we're starting to see some of the issues arise, particularly as it pertains to things like the cost of compliance. And really, in the world of AML, which is obviously our wheelhouse, it's the lack of automation in AML processes, whether it's filing the mandated reports to FinTrack, whether it's assessing customer risk, conducting ongoing monitoring. I think every operator that I've talked to, there's a lot of pain with how manual all these processes are. So I think that is definitely, and it's not just in AML. I understand there's other areas where automation would certainly smooth a lot of those speed bumps in the marketplace right now. And I think given where we are at the market, this is a critical time to start dealing with those pain points and seeing what solutions we can come up with. And again, this is partially, the timing was great in terms of Connectify approaching me. I'm happy to join Connectify. And I think we can offer some real solutions to some of those pain points right now.
And for some of our listeners, especially internationally, we have people that listen from multiple jurisdictions, right? When, like, coming from the United States, I think of anti-money laundering and I really look at it from the federal level. And I think there's an additional caveat with the way the Canadian market works. And there's probably additional provincial requirements that kind of add to this labor burden. So if you can break down a little bit how that works from FinTrack to AGCO to iGaming Ontario and where those additional compliance costs or requirements are building into this increased cost that even within Canada is probably maybe a little bit unique.
Yeah, and we could do a whole podcast just on conduct and manage, which is the three most dreaded words, I think, in the gaming industry in Canada. But so just for the benefit of the listeners, Canada's got a very unique legal gambling structure. And I guess to simplify it as much as possible, our gambling laws is rooted in our criminal code, which is a federal legislation that effectively says gambling's illegal. And then there's a very narrow window in which gambling can be legal. And one of those is if a provincial government conducts and manages gaming. So that's why you have this unique situation where you've effectively got two provincial government agencies involved in gambling. You've got the gambling regulator, which most folks in any jurisdiction around the world are going to be familiar with, right? There's someone that you have to get your license through. There's someone that oversees compliance, making sure the games are fair, making sure everything's, you know, conducted with honesty, integrity. But in Canada, you've got this added element of another provincial a government agency that conducts and manages, which, to simplify it again, is probably the revenue arm of the government. So unlike many regulators, say in the United States, where they're also focused on financial reporting because they want to ensure that the proper taxes are being remitted to the state government, in Canada, you've got another provincial agency that enters into commercial agreements with gaming operators. And then there's a revenue sharing aspect, which is effectively like a tax rate, if you want to call it that. So it's very unique. I don't believe there's really any model like it in any other jurisdiction. So it's to deal with that is can sometimes be difficult when, especially when Ontario opened up the market globally to anyone that effectively wanted to get licensed. There was a lot of questions about that because the folks in land-based gaming that had been operating in Canada for 30 years knew the regime, knew the landscape, and had found ways to work within it. But newcomers are definitely challenged by that. I think that context is somewhat important to your question, because when you look at what's happened in Canada in the world of AML, FINTRAC is primarily accountable for enforcing federal anti-money laundering legislation. In the United States, it's FinCEN, and in gaming, it's the IRS examiners that by and large are enforcing BSA compliance. In other jurisdictions like the UK, you've got your financial intelligence unit, but in the UK, it's actually the UK Gambling Commission that enforces a lot of the anti-money laundering rules. In Australia, you've got AUSTRAC, which is their version of FinCEN. Same thing, it enforces rules. Australia has been through a bit of a reckoning similar to Canada when it comes to money laundering in casinos. And so what you've seen in some jurisdictions is you've seen the gambling commissions take a much more active role in AML compliance and enforcement. Canada, you've got the Cullen Commission in British Columbia, which was for the gaming industry in this country was a watershed moment. Lots of allegations of dirty money working its way, not just in casinos, but in British Columbia in general, the real estate, high-end cars, things like that. Huge concern led to a commission of inquiry that the government called. Lost a bit of steam because of the pandemic. So in the middle of all this, there was a global pandemic. So the Cullen Commission, which was making front page news, dropped off for a bit, but they issued their report, I think it was about 2 years ago now. Lots of recommendations, many of which still have not been implemented. Some of them that targeting the gaming industry for things like mandatory identification checks in land-based gaming, lower thresholds for source of funds, inquiries on players. So that's certainly, from the Canadian context, the regulators in British Columbia and Ontario certainly took notice of what was going on. And I think in those two provinces in particular, you see a much more active role from the gambling commissions or the gaming commissions. Ontario, for example, the launch of the iGaming market certainly changed the dynamics. We needed to take, when I was at the AGCO, we needed to take a hard look at where the risks were. Safer gambling, which is a word that's starting to get used a lot, just ensuring player protection, ensuring that appropriate responsible gaming controls were in place, that appropriate prevention for criminal activity. So not just money laundering, identity theft and credit card fraud and all the wonderful things that happen with online commerce. So we took a hard look at that. And in my particular role, we took a hard look at what the federal legislation said and where we thought there might be gaps in terms of Ontario's gaming market. And so we addressed those both in the online and the land-based space.
Thank you for that thorough breakdown. I think it's really helpful to add that color and that perspective into how it works differently in Canada than other jurisdictions. And then when we get to these crown corporations where they do have these commercial contracts with operators, with your FanDuel's, DraftKings, BetMGM's, FitStars, and all those of the world, there's requirements on that end as well, on top of what the AGCO's requirements are. And that's where I think as you begin to see layer and layer how these compliance costs can really start to build up for operators trying to come in here. And obviously the point of these operations is to be able to turn a profit. And so I think that pain point is coming more and more to bear as we are encroaching on this 2-year mark. Again, largely, I think it's fair to call it a success the way the market has rolled out, but those are those pain points that I think we're seeing more and more given we've seen this Ontario model kind of start to, I don't want to say mature, but time has passed where everybody's taking a harder look at it, starting to make decisions. And other jurisdictions have obviously been watching closely. What are some lessons that you think other jurisdictions in Canada or even across the world that's looking at online gaming, some lessons that they could take from the Ontario model?
I think there's a lot of positives, obviously. Like I said, the low barrier to entry in terms of cost of entry to get into the market, the fact that there is no cap on the number of businesses that can apply for a license. The regulatory regime is also very standards-based, meaning that it's not, at least from the the gambling legislative perspective, you don't have a very heavy-handed prescriptive regime. A lot of it is based on operators deciding the best way to achieve the regulatory outcome. So that gives them some flexibility. I think the challenge is that in other areas, that flexibility doesn't exist. Federal AML legislation in Canada tends to be very prescriptive about things like how to identify customers, what transactions have to be recorded and reported. And then on top of that, because the federal regime actually makes the conduct and manage agency accountable for AML compliance, they tend to take a very risk-averse prescriptive approach as well to policies and procedures. So you've got quite a lot of players on the field, if you want to use a football analogy.
Sure.
When it comes to AML in Canada, much more so than other jurisdictions, operators that operate in the United States or the UK or Europe are probably not used to having that many players on the field when it comes to AML. There is discussions. There's certainly conflicting opinions on the legislative path forward. The Canadian government is currently reviewing federal AML legislation. They issued a discussion paper last year. One of the proposals, and I know Sean, you wrote a blog on that when the paper was released about Canada. But one of the proposals is to remove the conduct and manage agency from the definition of a casino, which would effectively put the compliance obligations directly on the operator. So again, a model that operators are very much used to, particularly in the United States or the UK, where there's a direct relationship between the operator and the Federal Financial Intelligence Unit. So they'd be accountable for reporting, they'd be accountable for compliance. As I said, I would not say that there's a unanimous viewpoint in Canada on this approach. There's certainly pros and cons to it. I would say one of the benefits of keeping the conduct and manage model in AML is a provincial viewpoint. So there is that sort of overall provincial view of the player. So if a player has multiple accounts at multiple operators, that the Crown agency would be in a good position to see that. Whereas without them, it would be a lot tougher. My own view, though, is that I think it's certainly there's a lot of benefits to going to a model that is much more familiar in the gaming industry, where the operator is effectively in charge of their own AML program, runs their own technical solution, does their own reporting. I think there's a lot of upsides to that. And it's going to be really interesting over the next year or two, because it's going to wind its way slowly through the Canadian Parliament. There'll likely be an election in the middle of all this in Canada as well. Although not quite as soon as the U.S. election, which is in November this year. But it'll be interesting to see where that all plays out. I don't think it's something that the industry should be holding its breath for, though, in terms of seeing where the Canadian government's going to land. I think particularly bringing this back to Ontario, lessons learned. I think there's an issue right now with AML compliance, and it needs to be addressed with sooner rather than later versus waiting for maybe a potential amendment to federal legislation. And so I guess I talked more about the Ontario issue there, but I would also say if there's lessons to be learned, it's if you're going to launch a market, because a number of other Canadian jurisdictions are likely looking at this, I think it's critical, AML being a significant pain point, it's critical that you've got that figured out when you launch. And if you don't have it figured out, that at least there's a roadmap to saying, here's how we're going to get into compliance, or here's our solution for AML compliance, I should say.
Yeah. And I think as those other jurisdictions look at what's gone on and we focus on that cost of compliance, is being dynamic enough or allowing the operators enough room, even if you don't remove, conduct and manage, allowing the operators enough room to bring in solutions so that they can get the job done. We're at a point right now with Ontario, right, where all operators more or less are having to manually file their CDR reports and their STR reports. And I think that's fairly unique across Canada. I'm not the expert, so I'll defer to you on that, in that more or less there's been some level of automation, or at least the ability to automate, and operators don't have that breathing room to be able to make those decisions right now. So I think that's such an important thing to take from this. Either one, have a mechanism to get that automation in place fast if it's going to be run by the Crown agency, but if not, giving the operators the room to make those decisions, which I think is more in line with what you've probably seen on the land-based side traditionally, and obviously what we're used to seeing in the United States.
Yeah, in fairness, the land-based industry has been around for over 30 years in sure. Canada, or about 30 years, give or take. So they've had a lot more time to work out the kinks. I wouldn't say that necessarily the land-based model should be held up as the model for iGaming. Very different business, and in some cases, even different player base. But yeah, in fairness, yeah, there is a lot more automation in land-based, but they've had a lot more time to develop solutions, at least in Canada. I would say my experience around the world, though, is there's in the land-based world, there's still a ton of folks that are, especially at the cage or at the tables, that are using paper, or they're just writing transactions down. And then it gets input into a system later. And it's just, that's especially with the smaller casinos that may not be able to invest in the type of technology that's required. But in the iGaming world, it's crazy that you're effectively doing all this data entry when it's digital. iGaming by its nature is digital. Manually keying in regulatory reports is a little crazy. And again, this is where I think there are some solutions. I agree with you 100% that the operators to a large degree can also be a lot more nimble than government agencies, that the government agencies are bound by procurement rules and a whole bunch of other policies that a lot of times the private sector can be a lot more agile in areas like that.
Procurement processes on the government side can take years. And that's if something comes to fruition. A procurement process can obviously occur and result in nothing. And you've got operations that are still there waiting if they don't have the power to bring in solutions themselves. I do want to switch gears a little bit and talk on the national level and on the international level, even compare Canada and the US a little more. Obviously on the US side, we recently had the National Money Laundering Risk Assessment come out. We've already covered some of it on our blogs and the US Treasury's view on gaming, which I think it's safe to say was less than rosy when reading through those documents. In particular, they decided first thing to point out the industry's own issue with being in compliance as one of the primary money laundering risks of the industry. But there was also this focus on state-by-state regulation, where the Treasury seems to put some blame almost on their regulatory regimes, or the variation between the regulatory regimes. And since you've come from Canada, where you do see maybe some more involvement, like the AGCO, obviously you're the director of AML there, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on this.
I think when you look at the gaming industry, or really any industry for that matter, but gaming is just, it's an industry I've worked in for a number of decades, and it's a great industry, but it's unique, right? Every industry has its quirks. And I think the state, in the case of the US or in Canada, the state level or provincial level gambling regulators are much closer to the industry in terms of understanding how things work, understanding the players in terms of the registrants and the licensees and whatnot. Whereas it's the same holds true, I think, in both Canada and the United States, where at the federal level with FinCEN and FinTrack, they're much more removed. They have a much broader mandate, right? They don't just regulate the gaming industry. They regulate banks and a number of other businesses. And so they don't necessarily have the in-house expertise that you would see at the state or provincial level regulator. And I think that's where those relationships really need to be leveraged. I certainly, in my role at the AGCO, we had a lot of dialogue with FinTrack at the federal level. FinTrack would hold about every year or so, they would hold actually like a gaming industry forum where they would invite various representatives from the provincial agencies to talk about issues in gaming. I don't believe FinCEN does something similar, at least with the gaming industry there. I think a lot of those initiatives are typically led through associations like the AGA, where they may have a forum. But certainly if I was to give any my kind of thoughts or any advice on that, I do think leveraging those relationships. So the National Risk Assessment did talk about the differences in regulation, but I don't know if that was an entirely fair comment. In my view, it is a fair comment in that when you're looking at it from a licensing and registration perspective, And this conversation has been going on as long as I've been involved in gaming. There's certainly every state, every jurisdiction has its own licensing requirements. There's certainly opportunities to streamline that and make it much more efficient and seamless for the folks that actually run the businesses. But that's not really in the AML front. On the AML front, you've got in Canada, you've got the Proceeds of Crime Act. In the US, you've got the Bank Secrecy Act. That's being administered by a federal agency. I think it would be in their best interest to leverage those relationships at the local level and understand the players there. Because whether it's Nevada, New Jersey, Ontario, British Columbia, the gaming regulators in those jurisdictions know the industry inside and out.
Yeah, and they're meeting with the industry frequently. They're working with them frequently. They're also auditing them frequently from other standpoints outside of AML. I think, and I've heard Joseph talk about this, having come from the banking side as well. In the United States, at least the FDIC does audits of the credit unions, whereas the IRS would do them for us on the BSA AML side. It seemed like there's a lot more coordination with state agencies from that standpoint. And I think a similar model could be leveraged. And so it's a model that we can draw from in the US that already exists to really help improve enforcement, learning, remediation, and all those aspects where they are leveraging those existing agencies. I think you've also got the additional layer of tribal gaming, right? And depending on the state gaming commissions may have zero or little involvement with the tribal gaming operators, depending on how the compacts are written. But then, even then, you still have the NIGC, which was a national standard setter and is within the federal government anyways, and that works very closely with all those tribal gaming operations. So there are knowledge centers that can be leveraged. So I think I agree with you in that bit of the assessment. It's a little unfair in that maybe the Treasury isn't looking at their own bureau enough on their responsibilities. It is a federal legislation and it has to be enforced at a federal level. So the state agencies only have so much control in that aspect over the Bank Secrecy Act and the Patriot Act. I think Canada recently also had a similar document released. I wonder if there's any parallels that you found interesting or if there's anything that can be derived from there as well.
They're really, in terms of a national risk assessment document, yeah, there was one released in Canada. It was, in terms of gaming, it was much more high level than the one that Treasury released. There was a communication almost simultaneously released by FinTrack on a bulletin on AML risks in online gaming, which to a degree would parallel some of the stuff that was in the Treasury risk assessment. But I would say if there's any takeaway from the Canadian FinTrack bulletin, it's a great argument for why other provinces should just regulate online gambling, because a lot of the FinTrack bulletin was focused on the illegal market that's largely controlled by organized crime groups and very bad state actors. And to me, the big takeaway from the FinTrack bulletin was this is a great argument for why there needs to be regulation and why what we call the gray market in Canada should move into the light, because as the expression goes, sunlight's the best disinfectant. So
I totally agree with you on that. And it's funny, you looked at the headlines or even some of the sub headlines within the bulletin. It sounds like it is primarily the risks of online gaming, but as soon as you really dive into it, the overwhelming majority covered the illegal gaming market. And so I think it does make a great argument for that. I think even in the National Money Laundering Risk Assessment for the United States, there was still a fair bit of that in there as well. So I think the same argument can be made in the United States. I think where also there can be some comparison between the US and Canada is really the way the federal regulation is written and the definitions in the federal regulations as we start to talk about money laundering. I think I've talked about this ad nauseum at this point in the United States, but the definition's outdated. The last time I think I saw FinCEN directly reference what a casino or wagering institution or covered institution under the BSA was in a 2007 FAQ, and we've had daily fantasy sports become overwhelmingly popular since then. We've had skill-based gaming become overwhelmingly popular and grow to lengths we maybe wouldn't have imagined back in those times. We obviously have online sports betting now. We've had online gaming, I think, since 2013, legal in all those states. And we haven't really seen that regulation change. And I think there's a similar track in Canada as well, right? If you can expand upon that maybe a little.
Yeah, there's gaps. So the U.S., Canada, very much like the U.S., the gaming industry has evolved considerably just in the last 10 years. You talked about sports betting. So you had PASPA repealed in 2018, I believe it was, in the U.S. That opened up sports betting outside of Nevada. In Canada, very similar. Single event sports wagering was illegal until I think they just had to pull out one or two words out of the criminal code, and suddenly it was legal. And again, in the AML world, the definitions are not entirely clear. In Canada, a lot of it will depend on where the activity takes place. If sports wagering in the physical world, if sports wagering happens in a casino, it's pretty clear that it's covered. But if sports wagering happens elsewhere, I don't think it's very clear at all whether it's covered or not. And the funny part is there's really only so many sports books out there. So it could actually be the same sports book where if they conduct business in this location, they've got to put all these AML controls in place. But if they do it in this other location, same company, but they're not subject to AML rules. So very similar. I know you and I have talked about this in the past, Sean, about the definitions are different in the BSA and in Canada's legislation, but the issue is the same. Ultimately, the high level issue is that the definition's desperately in need of updating because the gaming industry has evolved, and there's lots of forms of legitimate gaming that are there's a lot of question marks as to whether they're covered or not.
And what has the industry push looked like on the Canadian side? I know I can speak to the U.S. side in that, gosh, I think there's been calls for additional guidance since before PASPA even was overturned. Going back to 2015, obviously the AGA has made additional calls, released additional best practices where they're addressing AML within the sports betting and online gaming framework, even though it's not covered by the jurisdiction. And while the AGA has asked for guidance, obviously that hasn't gone anywhere to this point. But I think the industry and industries at large, when it comes to the federal government in the United States, they have a mechanism for trying to push legislation for themselves, and that they can actually do a petition of rulemaking to these bureaus. So public entities, public groups theoretically could make a petition for rulemaking to FinCEN to propose a new rule or an updated rule around the definition. Are there any similar efforts like the calls for guidance from the AGA, even though I think in this case it may be a rule change? Is there anything similar in Canada? And is there any similar mechanism to a petition for rulemaking like there is in the United States on the Canadian side that could propel these forward potentially?
Yeah. So unlike FinCEN, FinTrack doesn't really have rulemaking authority. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much their authority rests within the legislation and the regulations, which is really controlled by Parliament, so the government. And in Canada's case, the federal AML legislation, it's required, it's baked right into the legislation that it has to go through a parliamentary review every 5 years. So the best opportunity for any kind of meaningful change is during that review cycle, which, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, that's already in progress, although it's not a process that happens quickly. Certainly, similar to the AGA, the Canadian Gaming Association, I know, has set up a working group to look at it. Many of us in the industry have been involved in that working group to some degree or another. They've made their representations, or at least initial representations, to the federal government. I will give a shout out to the folks at the Department of Finance Canada who are leading the review, that they've been very engaged with industry, have had a number of meetings, and in fact made a point at the beginning of this cycle to actually visit some casinos and meet with some key public and private sector stakeholders. So I credit where it's due that the Department of Finance has certainly been very engaged on the gaming file, which is a little bit unusual. Typically, the casinos are not, or the gaming industry is not, a priority level. But I do think that in Canada, as much as in the U.S., the industry has gone through such radical change, particularly with online gaming and sports betting. You're seeing an expansion of the industry. And I think the government likely feels it's behooved to take a look at this finally and come up with hopefully a workable solution. So I'm not, the dynamic in the U.S. is different, because I don't think the BSA's got this sort of cycle where it has to be reviewed. Certainly in Canada, when the legislation was first passed in 2000, the definition of casino was even less clear. And in many cases, the private sector operators were interpreted as the ones who are accountable for this. Canada got rapped on the knuckles a bit by the Financial Action Task Force during one of its mutual evaluations and said, mm-hmm. hey, your definition of casino is really fuzzy. So they cleaned that up and they decided to put the onus on the conduct and manage agencies. So that is, again, the iGaming Ontario's, the Ontario Lottery and Gaming's, British Columbia Lotteries, Lotto Quebec, all those provincial government crown agencies. But I think what we've seen in Ontario with the opening of the online market and the introduction of single event sports betting is that model has definitely shown its cracks. Like I said, there isn't consensus. I wish there were a consensus in the industry about who should be accountable for AML compliance. There's certainly two schools of thoughts. But from my own perspective, having worked at this in different angles, I think staying with the status quo is just going to actually create more issues. It's going to create more compliance challenges for the folks who actually operate the business because it's not 100% clear. So I hope we can find a way forward. Certainly the Department of Finance proposed a definition that just focuses more on the activity of regulated mm-hmm. wagering. That's easier said than done. That's certainly in and of itself, that's a pretty loaded statement, but I think that's a statement that makes sense. And frankly, I think that's a statement that could apply in the United States as well, is that if you take back a very strict definition of what a casino or what a gaming organization is, and basically say, look, if it's regulated wagering activity where money is changing hands, it should likely be subject to AML requirements. And I think the devil at that point will be in the details as to, okay, then where do you go from there and what does that look like? But certainly, I think that's a more sensible approach. It's just easier said than done. As I said, there's a lot of finer points in there that would need to be addressed.
You've obviously been at this for some time now, so you've seen a few of these five-year cycles obviously play out. How significant have you seen the change from cycle to cycle? Obviously, you referenced the FATF hitting on the older casino definition and then making the updates. Not to say to give me odds if you were going to bet on this, but one, how likely do you think it is that definition does get updated as part of this next review round? And then I think probably the one that's more questionable is how likely is there a change or at least a different perspective into the conduct and manage aspect?
Yeah. I would say it's almost a certainty that we're going to see some amendments to the definition. I think there's some gaps currently that are going to create Canada some potential headaches during our next mutual evaluation. Like I said, we got Canada in 2005, I think it was, got wrapped on the knuckles about an unclear definition of a casino. So it's certainly within the realm of possibility that it's something the FATF will look at again. In the last the most recent mutual evaluation, which was 2018, I believe, to 17 or 18, there was a mention of First Nations gaming and some of the gaming that was happening in a gray area where it wasn't quite clear whether that was legal gaming or not. And so the FATF called that out. Frankly, that still hasn't been dealt with. There's still lots of questions about First Nations gaming and what's legal and what's not. But the bottom line is, I think I would absolutely put my money on the definition being updated. I think the real question is going to be is what does that look like and who's going to be accountable for AML compliance? I think that's where I'm a lot less certain as to what will that look like. But I think the government of Canada has no choice but to look at the definition and update it.
I think that's a fair assessment. And then conduct and manage seems very much up in the air at this point still.
Well, I don't think conduct and manage is actually embedded in the criminal code. And I don't see that going away. That's a whole separate other issue. But taking conduct and manage out of the AML legislation is a lot easier and not something that's going to impact the whole legal framework of gaming. It's basically just going to say, okay, you know, who's accountable or which entity is accountable for AML compliance. They could keep it, they could update. There's a number of ways this could play out. They could update the definition to ensure things like sports betting and other forms of legal wagering are covered, but they could still keep, conduct, and manage in there, which still means that the provincial agent or the provincial governments, frankly, are still on the hook for this. They could take conduct and manage out of the equation. And like I said, their proposal talks about focusing more on the activity of legal wagering. Again, that to me, I think that's the way to go, but there's a lot of, that raises a lot of questions that need to be answered. And I think that's where it's critical that there's consultation with industry. I think it depends on my own experience just in the last year since this cycle started, is you're going to get different opinions depending on where people sit. So some of the crown agencies have different opinions than the private operators. And even at the private operator level, I think there's not entirely a 100% consensus.
Derek, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think we're actually coming up on time, and this is a pretty natural stopping point. Really great analysis. Obviously, really looking forward to continuing to work with you. Welcome to Connectify, and thank you for jumping on for this conversation with us.
Thanks so much, Sean. And now I'm going to have to figure out some nicknames for you.
Thanks again for joining us today on Connectify Conversations. You can support our show even more by leaving us a rating wherever you download your podcast and by sharing Connectify Conversations with gaming industry leaders like yourself. Visit Connectify.com to learn more. That's KINECTIFY.com. Until our next conversation, always remember to minimize risk and maximize your efficiency.